We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Christopher Glasick. He is a contributing writer to Esquire magazine, has written in numerous publications, including The New Yorker, and has written in this month's edition of Esquire, The Secret of Family Making Billions from the Opioid Crisis. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
So, Chris, you know, we've on this program, we've talked a decent amount of the opioid crisis. I've sat down with lawyers who are bringing cases against the distributors, particularly of OxyContin, trying to get compensation for cities and states that have had to pay out public funds to deal with this massive crisis that we're dealing with. And you could maybe give us a little bit of statistics as to just how wide-ranging the opioid crisis is. But you've done an in-depth look at the family behind the company, Purdue, that has produced OxyContin. What was it? I mean, how hard? Let's just start with this. I mean, tell us who the family was, or is, I guess.
Right. So the Sackler family is a family of billionaires from New York City. The family started as three brothers who were born in Brooklyn in the 19-teens. And the patriarch of the family, Arthur Sackler, got his start in pharmaceutical advertising in the 40s and 50s. And he was actually a major innovator in the field of medical and pharmaceutical advertising. So, you know, when he kind of emerged on the scene at that time, all there was door-to-door salesmen called detail men. So pharma companies would kind of send these reps door-to-door to doctors to kind of try to sell drugs to them, and that still happens too. But Arthur's big insight was that you could use print advertising in medical journals to reach a much larger number of doctors more efficiently. And so he was actually the first person to get the Journal of the American Medical Association to include a color insert for a pharmaceutical drug.
Well, let's just stop there for a moment, because it is obviously, you know, you can look at the numbers and you can say, okay, there's a higher yield, right? Whatever the ratio is of people who will see those eyeballs and actually can, if not necessarily purchase, but prescribe his product, right? There's a lot of value there too. But I also would imagine that when you are advertising in a medical journal, that there's some other level of cachet, that there is almost like an implicit sense that, like, yeah, this is for real.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's channeling the authority of the medical journal to lend it this, you know, kind of scientific aura. And that's something that Sacklers have done again and again with tremendous success. You know, you could call it white coat washing. You know, they kind of present business objectives as medical objectives, and then they're able to kind of launder, you know, their companies and their family's reputation through the prestige of the medical profession.
I want to continue on with you telling us more about the Sacklers, but I want to circle back at one point to this whole story is, you know, basically comes down to an enormous amount of greed and just a failure of either the existence of safeguards or the failure of safeguards that are just simply not adequate enough to address and to mitigate this greed.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, I mean, the Sacklers have had some help along the way. You know, some of the biggest help they got was actually from the FDA, which made a number of mistakes in approving the original application for OxyContin.
All right, well, we'll get to the FDA in a second. So tell us more about these three brothers. One of them, Arthur, was an advertising whiz. The other two were doctors.
Well, so they were all trained psychiatrists, actually. They're MDs, and they were interested in psychiatry, and actually did a bunch of research into on the human brain. And the research was actually quite promising, and they were the first, for instance, to isolate cortisol as a kind of psychoactive substance. And, you know, at the time when they were doing their research, psychiatry was totally dominated by Freudians who weren't interested in the kind of biochemical explanations. So their work was kind of considered fringe. But they were real research scientists. Arthur was really the patriarch of the family, and he would often kind of find jobs for his younger siblings to take over. He was the one who coordinated the purchase of Purdue Pharma in 1952, but he actually had his brothers run it instead of him. Because he was a medical advertiser, it would have been a conflict of interest if he also had his own pharmaceutical company. But so he kind of he owned several companies secretly and would often have other people run them for him. But his brothers were kind of his understudies.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so so they so Purdue, like, what did they make leading up to why don't you explain how they came upon the idea of OxyContin and the idea of Contin?
Sure. Okay. Well, so useful to note that the family's first really big influx of cash, we think, came in the 1960s, because Arthur Sackler was the first one to, was the one who devised the advertising strategy for Valium. And he was, and Valium was manufactured by Roche, a pharmaceutical company, but Arthur was the ad man behind it, and he was compensated in terms of volume of pills sold. And what he did was quite, he pulled off a pretty remarkable trick. So Roche already had a benzo on the market called Librium, which is, virtually indistinguishable from Valium. Valium then was released under a different name, a slightly different dose, but it was marketed in a very different way. Librium had been targeted narrowly, for what at the time was called anxiety issues, although anxiety at the time wasn't quite the buzzword that it is now. But what Arthur did for Valium is he said, hey, there's all these other kinds of problems that people have, these physical somatic problems. They have headaches, they have trouble sleeping, indigestion, sexual problems. So he kind of invented this other concept called psychic tension, which they asserted was at the root of many of these physical problems. And the conclusion being that you could take a Valium pill to help with all these different kinds of physical problems you might have, because really what was causing the physical problem was psychic tension. So in this way, he made Valium the most widely prescribed drug in the United States and was the first drug ever to reach more than $100 million in sales.
Now, all right, this is a moment, I think, where people get sort of like surprised, where you can create an affliction and remarket an existing drug, and the FDA doesn't. I mean, it's all fine with
the
FDA.
This was the early 60s, remember, so there were not the same kind of safeguards in place and not the same degree of regulation of drugs that there is now. But even today, companies are given wide latitude with a lot of this stuff, and crucially, what the Sacklers ended up doing with OxyContin was actually extremely similar to what they did, what they had done with Valium earlier on.
All right. Well, tell us what kind of safeguards were available in the 60s. I mean, and then let's just compare it to where we are today to a certain extent, because was there any restrictions on this at this time?
So, there was actually, there was movement in the 60s to introduce more restrictive regimes, and there were these Senate hearings that Arthur Sackler actually had to testify before. And one of the things they were really worried about in the 50s, and Sackler was involved in this also, was with the overprescription of antibiotics. So these new antibiotics were coming on the market, and the companies were trying to sell them for all kinds of different conditions. But it was actually, they were worried about breeding antibiotic resistance, which we're still worried about today. In terms of the exact timing of some of these pharmaceutical reforms, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it would have not been until the 70s that some more restrictions were put on the claims that pharmaceutical advertisers could make. But certainly, in the 60s, there was not the same kind of restrictive regime. Today, the FDA allows pharmaceutical companies to make certain kinds of claims about their drugs, and then there's claims that they're not allowed to make. They're not allowed to exceed what the FDA label says, with some asterisks.
Right, and those asterisks very often lead to some pretty crazy and horrific outcomes, as like these drug companies try and push off-label prescribing for these drugs, but they do it in a sort of much quieter way. All right, so Sackler was innovative in that he had basically taken a bunch of pre-existing, I guess, states of being, bundled it up into a name that sounded like it was an official psychological problem, or I guess a neurological problem, and a marketed value, made it the highest grossing. I mean, can you still make deals like that today with your advertisers? Like, we're going to give you a commission? That seems to be bad.
It was very innovative at the time. I'm not sure exactly how those contracts are typically structured today, but I think that there are, you know, performance benchmarks that you're supposed to meet.
That to me seems really contrary to the Hippocratic oath.
Well, you know, so it makes everything a volume game, and it makes pharmaceutical companies just, you know, and their advertisers, their number one priority is just maximizing volume, and that has everything to do with the opioid crisis. You know, and people can kind of debate, like, what the best approach to, you know, regulating dangerous drugs is. And, you know, we have some people who advocate these very restrictive prohibition regimes, and other people think that, you know, drug use should be decriminalized. You know, one thing that's worth looking at, though, is that we have had this kind of controlled experiment with relatively unfettered, profit-driven, almost free market in prescription opioids. And when you attach a huge profit motive to that, you're inevitably going to get the volume going up and up and up, and that's what's happened.
All right, so Sackler is one of the first inductees into the Medical Advertising Hall of Fame.
That's right.
And those words also, I don't know, I find troubling, frankly. and so they're very wealthy, prior to OxyContin. They're a very wealthy family. They own just Purdue and then another drug company in the UK, or is this all part of Purdue, or what's the relationship between those companies?
Yeah, they talk about it as a family of companies, but yeah, there's related companies in the UK. Knapp Pharmaceutical is their big British wing. I mean, and today, I mean, there's literally hundreds of foreign entities that are all kind of connected to the Purdue family, but they're not technically subsidiaries of Purdue, but they're all owned 100% by the Sacklers.
I also appreciated...
I think they're all 100%. I should say, I'm not positive they're all 100%.
I appreciated the stories you told of Arthur Sackler's charitable giving to local museums in New York, because it gives a sense of just sort of, I mean, there's a certain mentality here, I think, that has to exist, right? As, you know, if you're going to sell this stuff and have some awareness, and we'll get into, you know, what awareness the Sacklers had, and Arthur, of course, was dead at that time. But if you're going to push volume, let's say, and sell it based upon, it's not outright fabrications, but just sort of like a very... a nuanced version of a fabrication, I guess, watching what he did with his tax deductions, his charitable giving. Just tell us a couple of stories or one that you cite in the piece from the Met.
Right. The Met was – so Arthur Sackler, starting in the 50s, became an art collector, and he pretty quickly amassed the world's most significant collection of ancient Chinese artifacts. And, you know, he kind of brought his acquisitive instincts to the art market and was kind of a master at acquiring new stuff and kind of cornering the market. And so museums were always really anxious to bag him as a donor, and the Met was kind of repeatedly trying to get him to donate money to the Met and to donate some of his collection. But Arthur kept imposing these really onerous terms. So the first donation he made, which is in 1963, he agreed to give, I think it was, you know, it was $150,000 or something. At that time, that was, you know, worth much more. But he required as a condition that the Met first sell to him a huge quantity of artifacts, but at the original 1920s prices for which they had been bought. Then Arthur would donate back the very same artifacts to the Met, but he would take a tax deduction based on their current prices. So, you know, so in effect, he was able to take a tax deduction that was so large that it was larger than the total value of his donation, most likely. So, you know, that was one thing. Another time when he gave money, he insisted that the Met make available to him this large cavern in the museum for him to store his own private collection, which saved him insurance costs and fire costs and all this stuff. So he had basically, there was a secret room in the Met to house Arthur Sackler's collection. And the Met was, you know, convinced, like, well, you know, eventually he'll just donate this stuff to the Met. So, you know, we're willing to play this game where we let him house it for free in our museum for a number of years. And it actually ended up triggering an attorney general's investigation, saying this was a misuse of public funds. You can't, you know, benefit this individual by allowing him to have his private collection in the museum. But eventually, Arthur got mad at the Met. They wouldn't give him a seat on the board. He was mad that there's all these homosexuals on staff. And he had a couple other misgivings about the way that his donations were being used. So he actually ended up donating almost all that stuff to the Smithsonian in Washington. So he kind of screwed the Met in the end.
And wait, how did that attorney general investigation work out? I mean, it seems to me that the Met was engaged in sort of that sounds a little bit illicit to me, too.
So they did not find any wrongdoing on the part of Arthur, but they did reprimand the Met.
All right. Fair enough. But we get a sense of just his sort of, I guess, his perspective on society at large. So Arthur dies and then his brothers buy his share in Purdue. When does that happen relative to OxyContin? Tell us, or start with the idea, the concept of Contin for us,
right,
and then we'll work.
Okay. So yeah, it's important to note that Purdue, you know, which they bought in 1952, was this really small, insignificant pharmaceutical company for years and years. It was kind of a midget in the industry, and they had a number of products, didn't really have any big hits. Their first big hit was actually they acquired the rights to Betadine, which is this antiseptic. And they had really good timing because they bought it just as the Vietnam War was ramping up. And so the U.S. government bought tons of Betadine to heal soldiers' wounds in Vietnam. But they didn't hit it big until they entered the pain business. And the way they got there was they had developed this time-released asthma medication that didn't really take off. But you know, according to the company lore, there was a doctor in London who worked for this hospice. It was actually kind of the world's first hospice. And he was aware of this time-released asthma medication, and he suggested to the Sackler's company there that they create a time-release morphine pill. And this would be great for the hospice, he said, because it would allow dying cancer patients to sleep through the night without an IV. You know, as it was at the time, they could take morphine, but they would have to take it, you know, in pretty constant increments. So if they could take a pill that was long-acting, it lasted 8 or 12 hours, then that would help people sleep. And so they took this advice, and they did create a time-release morphine medication called MS-Contin. Contin means continuous, and that refers to the time-release system that they developed. So MS-Contin became a hit in the cancer market, and it sold quite well in that small niche, and it brought a lot of prestige to Purdue as a company, which hadn't really had anything really successful before. So all of a sudden, they were involved in this really holy work of relieving the pain of dying cancer patients, allowing them to die with dignity, to sleep through the night. And so you know, this really put Purdue on the map. You know, one of the problems with MS-Contin, though, is that its patent was going to expire in the 90s, and they didn't have anything to replace it. And so people at the company, and you know, it was kind of around this time that the next generation started asserting control. This would have been Arthur's nephew, Richard Sackler, who really starts adopting a more important role in the company in the 80s. And they get the idea, what if we created a new time-release opioid? But instead of time-release morphine, what if we make it time-release oxycodone? And oxycodone was kind of a dusty old chemical. It had been around since the 20s, but it had a number of advantages over morphine. The most important one was that it was perceived by doctors as much weaker than morphine. And the reason for that was that it was in Percocet and Percodan, which are these relatively weak combination opioids that people take, you know, for injuries and stuff like that. morphine had this really kind of serious, kind of, you know, funereal reputation. People were like, oh my God, if I'm on morphine, that means I'm about to die. You couldn't get ordinary doctors to prescribe morphine. I mean, most never had. That was only something for, you know, cancer doctors. But ordinary doctors were very familiar with oxycodone because they prescribed it all the time in the form of Percocet. So, you know, and the company, you know, has acknowledged this in lawsuits, and I talked to employees about this. They played on this misconception that oxycodone was weak. In fact, oxycodone is even stronger than morphine on a milligram for milligram basis. But they, you know, they released OxyContin as kind of a successor product to MS Cotton, and it had immediately this kind of brand identity in doctors' minds that this was not as serious, that this was not as strong as MS Cotton, when in fact it was just as strong.
That's interesting. All right, so just to be clear, this was an active ingredient in Percocet that just because of the amount that was in Percocet made it less powerful. But
exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
So
you had a very small dose in Percocet. You know, like 5 milligrams usually. But with OxyContin, they released pills that were 20, 30, 40, even 80 milligrams of oxycodone in a single pill. You know, so that's like basically, that's 15 times as strong as it is a Percocet.
Tell the story of the doctors from Sloan Kettering in 1986, because this is something that I've also heard, that to the extent that there was any data points, I guess, that the OxyContin would be less addictive than Oxy, I guess, a similar opioid, it came from these two doctors I guess it's a study.
Okay, so there's a couple things that happened, the research that happened in the 80s, and there's a couple of kind of pivotal but kind of paltry little contributions to the literature that got cited again and again and again and kind of blown out of proportion. But that was not specifically comparing oxycodone to morphine or anything like that. That was just asserting that opioids in general, were safe and effective for chronic pain. And there was kind of notoriously a letter to the editor that was written in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1980, which asserted that the risk of addiction was less than 1%. But it was based on this like really small, unrepresentative cohort. And in fact, some of them had become addicted, and it was this whole kind of messy thing. The authors of that letter to the editor ended up renouncing it later. But in the meantime, the pharmaceutical companies got a hold of that. And then there were two doctors in New York, Kathleen Foley and David Portnoy, or sorry, Russell Portnoy. They published another study in 1986, which similarly concluded that long-term opioids were safe and effective treatment for chronic pain. So, you know, you have a kind of a couple things happening in succession. You have the hospice movement, which really takes off in the 70s. Then you have the palliative care movement, which is related. So you're getting doctors, you know, more and more used to prescribing powerful opioids in certain situations. But then you have these patient groups and a couple of doctors associated with them that want to push further. And they say, hey, these are so effective for palliative care. Why don't we use these strong opioids for all kinds of problems? And that's when the pharmaceutical companies really saw the opportunity, because they say, hey, this drug that we've been just targeting at the cancer market, why don't we target it at 30 million back pain patients? Why don't we target it at millions of people who have, you know, neuropathic pain? Why don't we target it at people with menstrual pain? You know, they target it at OBGYNs or at dentists to give to people with toothaches. And that's kind of taking Arthur Sackler's original insight with Valium. You have this addictive substance. At first, it's narrowly targeted, but what if you can just take that and then market it to a huge universe of patients, then you're really in the money.
And we should say that those two doctors, their study was of 38 people, which is
right.
Not exhaustive by any means. But the amazing thing is that's all it took. Like, it just it seems like there was a combination of three things. One is just a basic misunderstanding of the power of this drug. to a, you know, the scant research across the board so that you had outsized impact from what little there was. And three ends up being also just sort of like people not knowing the difference between oxycodone and OxyContin.
That's right. Yeah. You see, what you want to look at when you look at, these big social problems, we're encouraged to think of them as the result of these large impersonal forces that are really hard to understand and take place slowly over time. And, that's true to some extent, but that can distract from the fact that a lot of big social problems have their root in actions taken by individuals. And so when you're looking at something as complex as the opioid epidemic, you want to look at, who is benefiting most, who had the most aerial view of everything that was going on, who was able to manipulate, the other events that were taking place in order to maximize their own profits. And in looking at that, you really end up inevitably going back to the manufacturer, which is Purdue Pharma.
And what,
incidentally, which had much more knowledge about what was going on than the distributors did, which are kind of comparatively really bit players in this drama.
Well, all right, let's talk about what they know, because my understanding of the distributors, the reason why we're going to see a lot of litigation is that they had a statutory requirement to address any large blips in the prescribing and delivery, essentially, of medications to specific areas. And so after the first year, they may not have known the details of the problems with OxyContin, but they just knew from a sheer sort of trajectory, like, hey, something's going on here. And yet they had very, they had a statutory obligation according to the, via the DEA. That's what we heard about a couple of weeks ago when we heard that there were congresspeople and there was a nominee who was pushing changing that statutory obligation. But so what did Purdue know? Like, what did these guys know?
Well, this is really key because they knew much, much more than the distributors did. I mean, the distributors basically just take the pills from the manufacturer and deliver them to the pharmacy.
Right. So the distributors only had models of, we should be selling X amount of these pills in these locations on any given day. The pills could be anything. The only thing that they're measuring is actually just sheer numbers. That's the only data
they have. They don't know if there's a pain clinic in that town or there's a hospital nearby. I think that they made some mistakes, and I think that they should be held liable for those. But but it's important though to understand that what Purdue had access to was much more granular data. They had access to data down to the prescription level. Through this company IMS, which is a prescription data mining company, they had a they were able to see which doctors were prescribing what amounts in what areas. And Purdue actually kept a list internally of doctors they suspected of running pill mills, and they did not share that list with law enforcement for many years.
Wow. All right.
The manufacturers could only see one part of the chain. Purdue could see every step in the chain.
All right. Well, let's start, though, before we get to the actual distribution and this the idea that they're pill mills. But what did they know about their actual product that they were selling? I mean, it's one thing to say like, we're playing off of misunderstanding by doctors. We're playing off of misunderstandings by the general public. We understand this is a powerful thing. But we've had these two doctors who studied 38 people and it's fine. But did they have reason to believe provable reason to believe that this stuff was so dangerous?
Well, they had conducted studies, internally that suggested addiction rates much, much higher than 1%, as much as 12 or 13%, and they kind of, tried to downplay those findings or suppress them in a way. Did they know that they were creating, a generation of addicts? I haven't seen the kind of smoking gun with respect to that, although I think some people are looking for it. But they certainly had reason to believe that these statistics they were citing, saying that like the risk of addiction is less than 1%. I mean, that was plainly ridiculous.
And so, okay, so now let's get to that part about at what point did they start to, What point do they start to keep these records about these pill mills? That's incredible.
Right. So this was uncovered during an excellent Los Angeles Times investigation that was published last year in 2016, and that was kind of, you know, looking at that was part of my inspiration for looking into the family. So they basically had lists of doctors that were prescribing suspiciously high amounts of the maximum dosage pills, which were the 80 milligram pills, and they did not share that list with law enforcement. But basically, they discouraged sales reps from communicating with those doctors, and sales reps, I think, actually did not get a bonus for selling to those doctors because those doctors were already selling so much they didn't need any encouragement. You know,
were they was that a cost savings thing or was that a liability saving thing? Like, I mean, were they basically saying like we don't need you to push it there, and we're not going to give you, you know, you're not going to get the sales bonus. It's unfair that you have a pill mill there. You can't do that to get your trip to the Bahamas or whatnot because,
right,
you know,
right.
Fred doesn't have one in his district.
And sales reps would complain about that a lot, actually. You know, you're saying, or was it?
Or was
a
it like
issue?
A tacit admission that, like, let's not be aware of what's going on in door number three?
Right. So, you know, I'm not sure that I don't know that I can answer that question because I've heard different things. The sales reps definitely are of the view that the system was designed merely to deny them bonuses. So they think that this is just, you know, an excuse for the company to stiff the sales reps, like, and not compensate them for doctors who's writing a huge number of prescriptions in their district. But it also changes at different points. So in the beginning, they didn't have this system in place, and sales reps who did have pill mills in their district were getting huge bonuses, and that caused a lot of bitterness too, because, you know, not every sales rep did have a pill mill in their district. So what exactly the company's motivations were for keeping that list, I'm not sure that's been settled, and I think that's the subject of some litigation.
What were the statutory requirements, and what are the statutory requirements? What are the FDA requirements of a company that produces drugs, and then B, like, I mean, it seems to me like they could say, like, yeah, that we just kept those documents about the pill mills for internal reasons. You know, it's not fair to our other salespeople that, you know, if we're selling candy, to have, you know, one guy who has all of the elementary schools in his. But I mean, like, what statutory obligations do they have as manufacturers of the pills?
Well, I mean, this is part of the problem with the FDA process, is that once the FDA approves a drug, it's generally been held that manufacturers have very little responsibility. So you can compare it to something like, Takata airbags or whatever. So Takata is a Japanese company that created these faulty airbags, and it's the biggest airbag company in the world. And the patriarch of the family, Mr. Takata, he had to resign, and the company basically went bankrupt in the last couple of years because their airbags killed like a couple people. I mean, really, it was like less than 20 people or something like that. But they had to give this big press conference, and the patriarch of the family had to apologize and bowed his head in silence for a couple minutes, and he kind of fell on his sword in this dramatic fashion. And, you know, when you compare the harm caused by these airbags, the harm caused by Oxycontin, I mean, it's laughable. Oxycontin is, you know, thousands of times as deadly. But because it's an FDA-regulated and approved drug, that has made it difficult to go after the manufacturer, and you really have to demonstrate, some real deviousness in order to do that. People are asserting that now, though, and are going after them.
That they were hiding information that they knew and misrepresenting, willfully misrepresenting, that type of thing.
Yeah, there's many different issues that are being looked at. It should be noted, though, that, I mean, so Purdue in 2007 did have to agree to plead guilty to criminal charges, and three of its top executives actually also had to plead guilty to criminal charges, and the company had to pay $600 million. The executives had to pay like $30-some million out of their own pockets. This was an enormous settlement at the time in 2007, And very, very rare for a company and its executives to plead guilty to criminal charges, you know, not just civil charges. And so at the time, this was considered to be a great victory for the government. But, you know, there's a couple, a couple footnotes there. One is that at that time, it was not known exactly how deadly and catastrophic the opioid epidemic would become. And secondly, even though it looked like the top people in the company all went down, because it was the CEO, the chief medical officer, and the general counsel, the family members who owned the company and who filled more than half of the board seats and who actually supplied the company's top executives, they were mentioned nowhere in the settlement. And the guy who went down, who was the CEO, he had actually recently been promoted to CEO. He was not the CEO during the time that OxyContin was developed and promoted. That person was a Sackler family member, but they escaped totally untouched by that settlement.
Wow. So,
and in the media, you know, nobody ever, the word Sackler came up nowhere, you know, and all, there's a lot of media about the settlement at the time. It was a really big deal. They actually had hearings in the United States Senate, about whether the punishment was, you know, too light on the executives, and barely anybody, it was really just one person who was the mother of a victim, ever mentioned the word Sackler.
Does anybody ever refer to that CEO as the fall guy?
Well, you know, he did play an important role at the company. He had been the head of marketing before he became the CEO. But, you know, and I kind of asked people, you know, employees who had worked at the company, if they thought that this guy was really taking the fall for Richard Sackler, who was the president of the company, you know, people did not really seem to be of that opinion. You know, they thought that Friedman, you know, was quite involved in stuff, and, you know, and then Sackler maybe was involved also. But I think that the Sacklers were generally more popular among the employees than these executives were.
It's nice if you can pay the bonuses. And we should say that the fines that Purdue paid represent, like, relatively, like, what? Like, you know, upgrading the desserts in the commissary or something? I mean, relative to their profits?
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe like, they've made, you know, $35 billion in revenue from OxyContin. So you compare, you know, $600 million and change to $35 billion, you know, it doesn't seem like that much, a couple percent.
So where does all this stand now? I mean, are they, the Sacklers are getting a little bit of attention now, nothing relative to the havoc that has been, and the sheer suffering and death, frankly, that their product has created in this country. Like, where is all of this now?
Well, their company is in really big trouble in the United States, and there have been dozens and dozens of lawsuits filed by cities, counties, states, and the trajectory of this is, it looks very similar right now to what happened with the tobacco litigation in the late 90s, you know, and under that settlement, the master settlement for big tobacco, companies had to pay more than $200 billion. So, I mean, it's really a massive, massive thing. So a lot of people think that this is trending in that direction, that, you know, so many lawsuits are being filed against Purdue in so many jurisdictions that they're going to have to settle. Like, the game theory of it is such that they really cannot afford to litigate all these things individually, even if they thought they would win, which is not at all clear. So the company is in really big trouble, but the Sacklers have all these international companies also, and that's where the real growth opportunity is now. So, you know, OxyContin is kind of, you know, on the wane in the United States, and the CDC last year issued these very restrictive guidelines, basically suggesting that people not prescribe opioids for chronic pain at all. So the United States market is waning, but other countries have not had prescription drug epidemics yet. So, you know, other countries, you know, the United States still consumes a hugely disproportionate share of the world's opioids. Canada does also, it should be said. But the company, so the Sacklers now, their companies are on the march in Brazil, in Colombia, in China, they're trying to make up for the shortfall in the American market by going abroad. And this is a strategy also quite reminiscent of what Big Tobacco did after the late 90s, when, you know, they're running into all this regulatory trouble in the United States. So what do you do in that case? That's when you go abroad.
And are there, I mean, you know, with tobacco, I could see how it would have been super easy for the tobacco companies to begin to do this abroad. But is there not any protections for those? I mean, are there not entities in these other countries that are saying, like, wow, here comes this tidal wave. We just saw it wipe out an enormous amount of lives in the United States. It's just not the same mechanisms or what?
Well, so, I mean, that's an interesting question. Most countries have much weaker regulatory regimes in general than the United States does, and not the same kind of restrictions on various kinds of advertising. Although pharmaceutical advertising is kind of a special case, and the United States actually has an unusually liberal pharmaceutical advertising regime. Also, most countries have a socialized healthcare system. So if you're talking about the government, and is the government really going to pay, in Brazil or in European countries to get the whole country hooked on opioids, then that can be kind of a tall order. So the United States, is generally the most profitable market for pharmaceutical manufacturers, and there are some barriers in terms of distribution in other places, but if you're willing to go around the system, if you want to sell pain pills, outside the socialized system, in countries like Brazil and Colombia, then that presents some opportunities.
Hmm. Chris Glazek, the piece is The Secret of Family, Making Billions from the Opioid Crisis. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.